From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your direction. This hour, we'll be joined by Brilliant Holly Hand, the host of the Brilliant Holly Hand Show. He'll be in studio. And also, Lawrence Jones is here, back in action after his detached retina surgery. He's getting better every day. Looks great. Looks as sexy as ever. That's my opinion. I've not seen a study. I haven't seen confirmation, but I'm not looking for confirmation, Lawrence.
You can't tell another man that, but okay, I appreciate it. I mean, the producers agree.
A secure man.
Allison agrees.
A secure man can say that about another man.
But maybe handsome, but not sexy.
Oh.
Like, that's just like, you might as well say I'm drop-dead gorgeous.
Well, you would have liked that better, probably. You probably would have. So listen, I want to get to Lawrence's surgery, but also, Lawrence, you got to weigh in on Don Lemon and so much more. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
If this regime falls, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, they all go. It'd be the biggest change since the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Iran watches on as the evil Ayatollah emerges from his bunker to threaten the U.S. and the EU. What should we do? I'll weigh in.
Number two.
Last night's victory was historic in so many ways. Look, this is a seat that hadn't elected a Democrat in over 34 years. It's a plus 17% Trump district. Our candidate won decisively last night.
Yup, that is Ken Martin running the DNC, feeling pretty good about himself. Midterm warnings for the GOP as they lose another state solid red seat in solid red Texas. We're going to look at the polls, see what Lawrence thinks about that, the candidates, the fundraising, and more.
Number one.
So for me, people are dying, and, you know, I don't think America really wants people going after otherwise hardworking migrants in these communities right now. Yeah. That's where I'm at.
DHS under scrutiny as the government shutdown is all about ICE as protests continue. So did the illegal immigrant expulsions as Dems look to maximize their momentary political advantage. But where is it going for now? And if you want to know about the government shutdown, the Hakeem Jeffries comes in. He says to Speaker Johnson, even though you approved all the appropriations bills in a bipartisan way, yeah, Dems got a lot of what they wanted and passed it to the Senate, went home. They had to come back. Because they want to deny the DHS funding because they want to change some policies, Lawrence. And Hakeem Jeffries called Speaker Johnson and said, we are not giving you one Democratic vote. You need 70. We're not giving you one.
Yeah. Hoyer, who used to be in leadership, doesn't agree. The congressman from South Carolina doesn't agree. Clyburn doesn't agree as well. This is the first time in years where all members of both parties had a say in the process because they went through the appropriations process. So they passed all the bills out of committee. Everybody had a say. And the Dems, because they want to be anti-ICE, want to blow it all up. And we're going to allow them to do it. Now, it seems like the reasonable voices are saying, don't do that. But Hakeem Jeffries doesn't want to piss off the AOCs of the world.
Right. He doesn't want to do that. And he goes against Senator Schumer. I think it doesn't make Schumer look too good because he said, why don't we fund everything and for 2 weeks hold back the Department of the DHS funding, at which time we want to negotiate with you, Mr. President, on, and this is what they did directly, on policies. And they said, okay. And then the House said no.
Right. But Brian, Schumer as well as Jeffries are under the same scrutiny right now. What the progressives are saying and the activists
led
in the middle
Bernie
street,
Sanders.
Bernie, AOC, Mondami of the world, even though Mondami seems to have a better communication strategy. He picks up the phone and calls the president, tries to come up with some type of deal. But they're under the same scrutiny, which is don't give Trump what he wants by any means, circumstance. And you made a great point this morning about when it comes to the economy. They realize that when they shut down the government, it tanks the economy. It hurts the president. It slows down some of the trajectory that we're on currently. And I think they're willing to do that for election purposes.
But you want to see how bad it's gotten and why I believe Democrats will eventually overplay their hand? They're looking at all these white women organizing these anti-ICE protests in Minneapolis. And they're starting to rally, do the same thing in New York for when New York gets surged. And the president's reevaluating whether he's going to hit these Democrats. democratic cities. But you want to know how bad it is? These are the things they're asking for ICE. They're saying, put your name on your uniform, take your mask off, get a judicial warrant before you go anywhere, which is a non-starter, and get body cameras and no more roving patrols. When it comes to roving patrols, okay. When it comes to body cameras, yes, I would embrace them. People need to see what you see, and they're going to love it. But the other stuff is not going to work, right?
No. So I'm just practical. I like the way law enforcement has traditionally been done. So if you got criminals out there, you got to go out them. And if they're dirtbags, I don't care. You got to use the necessary force when it comes to that. But when you're going to different work sites and all, you got to have probable cause. Now, if you get intelligence saying there is a criminal there, that's one thing. But you can't just be going everywhere asking people for the driver's license. I think that was the flaw there.
Right, right.
So, but the Democrats, and this is the part that's enraging me. We're being practical about it, saying, let's make a few adjustments. They're not saying that, though, Brian. They're saying shut down all ICE operations. And then they're saying, when it comes to the illegal immigrants, that we want criminal warrants. When people apply for asylums, that's an administrative process. The administration are getting administrative warrants. They want a criminal process for the warrant process, but they want a civil process for the asylum process. That's a non-starter.
Well, listen how extreme this conversation's getting. The Larry Krasner, the DA over in Philadelphia, said this. Cut eight.
I want you to understand that just as you have come together, there are state prosecutors coming together right now to make sure that people understand there will be accountability. There will be accountability now. There will be accountability in the future. There will be accountability after Trump is out of office. If we have to hunt you down the way they hunted down Nazis for decades, we will find your identities. We will find you. We will achieve justice.
So they are talking about ICE agents and comparing them directly to Nazis.
I'm glad the governor of that state condemned those comments on Bret Baier, because Bret Baier asked him about that. And you wonder why they wear masks. This is exactly why they're wearing masks, because the threat level, because of idiots like this. Now,
he is an idiot.
Now, by the way, Brian, has he said anything about the criminals that he allows the dirtbags back on the street? Does he talk about them that way? He has more anger against the law enforcement professionals out there that are trying to round up people that want to do harm to this country right now.
Right. A couple of things. So John Fetterman also took him on. Listen to this. He's also Pennsylvania, obviously. Cut 10.
He really ought to lighten up, Francis. You know? and it's like don't call people and compare people to Nazis. I mean, like I said, you really ought to lighten up, Francis, and that's really honestly the truth now. And like a lot of the tough talk coming out of his office, that's just pandering to people. Now, for me, we all agree, deport all the criminal migrants. Mm-hmm. I do support that, and I think we should have a support. You know, our border right now, secure that. So for me now, you know, D.A. Krasner don't agree on some things and these things, but I'm not going to criticize or attack him in some kinds of ways. But regardless, that's a hard rule for anyone. Don't compare anyone to Nazis.
No, I'm going to attack him because I think it's beyond the pale. Like, you can have policy disagreements. I expect that. If you want to change the legislation, we can debate that. If you want to tamper down some of the operations and you want them more targeted, we can talk about that. But labeling a whole group of people that swore an oath for about $75,000 a year, who are mostly Hispanic, and to say that they hate their own people, I'm sorry, I have no patience for that.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. One thing you got to do, if you want to compromise on some of the roving patrols that you claim are roving, maybe get a further definition about what they could be, here's the deal. I need access to your prisons.
Yes.
And what I'm saying, they're prisoners already. Right. I'll take them off your hands. It won't cost you a thing.
Right.
I'll make sure they're deported, put into a federal facility.
Right.
That'll help get the criminal numbers up.
Right.
And make people feel safe. Now, what about this story that covered in the New York Post yesterday? There's this This is unbelievable. They have this guy under surveillance. They have him under arrest for shoplifting. They look into his background, and they look into the background of this guy. His name is Gerardo Miguel Mora. And it turns out he is accused of rape. He is attempted rape, I should say. He's accused of DWI. He has been somebody that they've seen consistently violating the law. Excuse me. A rap sheet includes crack possession, attempted rape, reentering the country illegally 3 times. He's in front of a judge for shoplifting, and ICE is there outside because they're not allowed in.
Right.
And the judge says, okay, you're allowed to go free, and lets him out the side door. When ICE realizes this is happening, they got to chase this guy down for blocks. They finally get him. And the one who let him go, Judge Sheridan Jack Brown. What do you say to people? This is a woman. What do you say to people like this?
Well, what I say is she needs to be served the warrant.
Yes.
For obstruction of justice, impediment of law enforcement. And she should go down just like the other judge that allowed him through the back door as well. You can't have that. How do you sit on the bench and have a repeat offender like that? Let's just start with not even the violent offenses, but you've been deported 3 times and you came back into the country. I'm sorry.
Gone.
That's a problem. You got to go. No debate about it. I don't want to hear a sob story. You just can't do that because you don't respect our laws in this country. So, Brian, I do fear this. They're winning on this right now because
no
of the visuals. The visuals. We and this is no disrespect to our country, because I think it talks about the heart that we have. We are an emotional group of people. You know, as hard as we wanted enforcement on the border, the moments we start seeing different pictures, kids every single day get ripped away from their families. But you see a little boy on there and they tell you a story about his background and all that. No matter if his father committed a crime or not, it weighs on the American public. And so the administration has to just, you don't stop all operations, but you can't be tone deaf to the emotional populace that's out there right now. This could have been avoided. Warned you that this was going to happen. Warned you this was going to happen.
So let's talk about politics before you go, because we got Lawrence Jones here. We don't want to wear him out too much. His first day full-time back, although we were lucky enough to have you join the show. There was a special election in Texas, state Texas, and I know there's some quirks to it. Bottom line is, President won that district by 17. This Democrat won by 14, even though he's outspent 10-1. There's a lot of people who see warning signs for Republicans when it comes to the midterms. Here's Lonnie Chen, a conservative from the Hoover Institute. Cut 20.
The setup here is not great for Republicans as we look ahead to the midterm elections. If you think about it historically, President Obama in 2010, President Clinton in 94, they had approval ratings higher than where President Trump is now. They lost 50 and 60 seats respectively. So the challenge we're seeing now is that the focus on the immigration issue, which had been an advantage for Republicans, is kind of turning in the other direction. And you also have floating around the affordability question, which that is going to be top of mind for voters. So immigration was a huge advantage for the president, a huge advantage in the election in 2024. Instead of talking about border security, the sort of domestic stuff that we've seen in Minnesota and elsewhere, I think has caused people to really change their minds and change their opinions about the handling of immigration. And it's turned a positive, unfortunately, into a potential negative.
I could go through it, and I went through it on Fox and First, the map. And, you know, the first election, the Republicans did get a majority of the share, but the candidates hated each other. And then, you know, it was a nasty campaign and some of the voters stayed home.
It was a jungle primary.
Terrible primary. They got the majority of the share. And then during this runoff, those Republican voters stayed at home. They only had 15% of the share. But if you look at the map, you see the difference in the Hispanic vote that were Republican, and they don't agree with socialism, and they're not open borders, and they agree with getting the criminals out, but they don't like the way the operations are being run. And I'll just say this to my Republican friends, because I agree with you. I understand why you want to go hard. What happened the last 4 years was terrible, just allowing 10 million people in. But you have to make a choice. Either you're going to tailor the operations.
Worst first.
And try to figure out this, who else is next, or in the sense of who gets a work permit and who's barred permanently from getting legal status. And you can see on a portion of it, or you go all guns blazing and you're going to lose. And you're going to lose big time. And all of those seats that you're talking about redistricting, which you're running on Hispanic voters that are Republicans now, you're going to lose those seats.
Right. You're going to might lose the Senate.
That choice is up to the party, what you want.
Right. Lastly, Don Lemon, you see him on camera with the protesters. They end up storming the church. He was sitting in the church prior to the protesters standing up. He was doing stuff after. To me, he was like the videographer of the organized insurgency, and he got arrested. He says he's claiming First Amendment. I'm a journalist. Where do you think this is heading?
Brian, I have been covering protests since Ferguson on the ground. Live coverage. I don't kiss the protesters on the cheeks. I don't pass donuts out to the protesters.
Hot chocolate.
I don't. I don't get operational plans from the protesters, and I certainly don't participate. And if I've ever seen a protester storm a federal building or a church or anything, I don't participate in it.
Instead, he was in there interviewing, forcing the pastor
after they told him to leave. And that's cited in the indictment.
Right.
So
they said it's going to get a lot worse for him. They said, I think he's got a surge of popularity, but he's ultimately going to pay even more of a price. Lawrence Jones, welcome back.
Thanks, big guy. Appreciate you.
Back in a moment.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I think we need to take a step back. The economy is quite strong right now on top line growth. So if you look at GDP, gross domestic product, which is the overall output of the U.S. economy, we're trending about 5% right now, which is a very high growth rate in the United States, much higher than the baseline we've had for the last decade. Mm-hmm. So if you look at that number alone, and that's a good number to look at, things are going well. The inflation rate has come down to the high 2%. It's still higher than we'd like it. And the unemployment rate is ticking up, but it's still in a reasonable place around 4-4.5%. So overall, the economy is quite strong right now.
So Gary Cohn, who used to run Goldman Sachs, was weighing in on the economy and used to be an economic advisor to President Trump in his first term. But, you know, he's not one of those people that Trump, right or wrong, he calls as he sees it. The numbers are unbelievable in terms of GDP growth in this quarter, over 4%, 4.4. And is projected, according to the Atlanta Fed, in June of being 5, over 5. We never saw any. I don't even remember. They say at least 10 years. I think it's even longer. And that's what we have now. Unemployment's still, historically low. Well, it's slightly up. But we have a readjustment period. Well, how do we continue to get the deficit down and continue to have it grow and have it wages go up? That's going to be the key. And I just think you have to leave things as they're going and see if you can adjust things on the way. You know, gimmicks like 10% of the credit card and things like that are not going to be effective. Holding steady will be.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back, and it's good to be back on a busy, busy week. And, of course, people are talking about the Texas election yesterday that went to Democrats. We're also looking at the midterm election and the controversy in Minnesota, Minneapolis, the shutdown that's going on right now, and handling all of it is Brian Hollihan. He's the host of the Brian Hollihan Show. He's in studio, and it's great to see you.
Thanks for having me in person. This is fun. It's a little colder than Alabama, where I'm from, attending college.
But is Alabama pretty cold right now?
It's cold. It's 18, and it was 8 when when I got up here this morning.
So and how unusual cool. is that?
That I've never seen. My 19 years in Alabama, I've never seen it. It's right. insane.
And you're in college now.
I'm a freshman.
Right. So we did meet before, and we just yes. found, I thought I found your picture. We met when the Andrew Jackson book was out.
You came to Birmingham. I got to go to the bookshop, so this was pretty fun.
Oh, that was great.
That was my assigned reading for that week. I was in fourth grade at the time, I think, and I got to do that as my assigned reading homework. I got to read your Andrew Jackson book, so and it worked for class.
You've always been politically oriented as a kid. Where'd it come from?
Yeah, so neither of my parents were political. My dad's in construction, mom was a teacher. And one night they happened to be watching one of those Trump-Clinton debates in 2016. I looked up for my spelling homework at that moment where Trump said that Clinton would be in jail if he got in office. And I was like, who is this guy? Because like the politicians I'd seen on TV growing up were Bush and Obama. Like they came with a talking point memo script, yep. a consultant handed them, and they didn't shy away. And I was like, who is this guy? But I didn't know political parties. We hadn't learned that
and
yet.
How old are you this time?
I was 10. So that got me interested, started watching. The next summer, I started the first podcast. Charlie Kirk was the first guest. It started the entire journey going across the country.
You DM'd Charlie.
DM'd Charlie. Just asked. He was coming to speak at UA. Asked for 10 minutes of his time. He gave me 30. And it was a cool opportunity to like, even at that time, he was such a huge figure. I mean, this is probably 8 or 9 years ago. And getting to look up to somebody like that as a mentor in this movement, I mean, that was huge.
Yeah, and how did that relationship grow?
Oh, the entire time. I mean, we would go to campus tours together. He came back on the podcast. We talked up until the morning before the assassination. He was genuinely a friend and mentor of somebody. You know this business. It's cutthroat. It's vipers. It's people stabbing you in the back who always think it's a competition, a race to the top. And Charlie was just like a friend. He was like helping me with my first book and offering advice when he saw, you know, my appearances on Fox. And the last conversation we ever had, I was, I think, on Mornings with Maria the next day. And he happened to have called it. And keep in mind, Charlie Kirk's a busy guy. He was probably in between prepping for his show and probably flying somewhere. He happened to see the segment and offered me feedback and was like, you did really good with this point. Expand on this. And that was the last conversation we had. Offering feedback of somebody that, in the media's eyes, could be competition. Two young people on TV. He just wanted to help. He wanted to grow the movement. That was all he did his entire career. And I think that's why you've seen so many people like in the void, like step up as to carry on the torch. Because have you ever... ever in your all of your experience ever seen a stadium packed full for an arena? That's how much influence he had on our generation.
So he has that influence. What is how have you handled his death?
Yeah.
And how has it affected you personally and professionally?
Definitely been very difficult. I think I slowed down a little bit in December just to be home with the family and come home from college. And I think it hit a little bit more then of like, he's really gone. There've been several times that things have happened. I get career opportunities or, you know, some crisis comes up and I want his advice. And I've like up until the last few weeks, taken out my phone, typed his name in to call him. And I'm like, he can't answer anymore. It was really, really, really hard the first day. I was walking back from English class and I got the message. He was on the way to the hospital to start praying. I'm like, what do you mean on the way to the hospital? What happened? And then obviously, unfortunately, saw the video and found out what happened. The instant reaction, I was on Will Cain, like when they announced it, in the moments after the announcement. And Will asked me a question about, you know, hey, like, are you going to like slow down? Like, you're not, I've spoken on campuses for years. You're obviously not going to keep, you know, going out there full force standing on campus holding a microphone. And I remember kind of pausing at the end of the interview because I mean, I just found out, you know, what, 5 or 6 minutes before that he has killed and freezing and saying, well, yeah, I mean, Brian, it would be really easy to put down the mic right now, like to go to the comfort of my classroom, not have security walking with us, to not have the death threats that we're getting daily, to walk on these campuses and just carry out the legacy. So in that interview, I was like, I mean, I'm grieving and I'm scared. Yeah, it'd be really easy to stop. But I froze and I said, no, Will, I'm actually going to do more. And after the assassination, we went on and did 10 college campuses last semester. I've spoken
separate,
at seven high schools.
From totally, Turning Point.
Yeah. Turning Point chapters on campuses.
Okay.
So getting to kind of work with some of their local groups. The last week I've spoken at seven high schools. The whole point is to carry out the mission of getting young people involved. I mean, this is the same analogy, and you'd understand this, that I gave to high school students just last week. You can graduate high school and never have to use algebra again. You can graduate high school and never have to do chemistry or write an essay again. You can't graduate high school and never be affected by the government again. For the rest of your life, you're voting, you're paying taxes, government legislation impacts your life. So paying attention very early on is important, and that's what Charlie was so big on, getting people registered. I went to seven schools in the last week, did a simple thing called throwing up a QR code on the screen, telling them to take out their phones that every single high schooler has, and ask them to register to vote on the spot. It's so simple, and unfortunately, schools aren't doing it.
What states are you having the most success in? Which ones are pushing back on you?
So a lot of the more up north states have given us some more trouble. I started in Alabama, my home state. We're trying to expand a little bit. I'll say for campus-wise, like colleges are a little bit different. I got to speak at Harvard last semester and do some stuff with them, like virtually come in. And like I was expecting like extreme pushback and protests and like, you know, some crazy actions. This is Harvard, right? And like legitimately, we had some of the more interested people that were kind of waking up around the time of the election and saying, maybe I was lied to my whole life. And we got probably more questions of people curious about becoming a conservative on Harvard's campus of all places and anywhere else. That kind of inspired me that people are awake.
But you're not, but people aren't speaking from the same hymnal, which is fine.
Yeah.
But people are, I don't care if, you know, hey, this is how I feel about abortion. Sure. This is how I feel about government spending. This is how I feel about action in Iran, Venezuela, Cuba. I get it. Go ahead. You know, critical thinkers are going to differ, but debate, fine. But when people just say Charlie was taken out by the Israelis, or was all the theories that go around about his death, that they was really military that did it. They were running on campus. This guy didn't shoot him. You know, why haven't they come clean on the investigation? So you're hearing these theories run wild, and I think it's affecting everything from his death.
Especially our generation.
And his legacy.
Yeah. You have an option. You have an option to sit in the corner and weep and moan and cry and still be in mourning after the assassination. You have the option to do what the rest of us did and pick up, still upset, and keep fighting as he would want us
or
to.
Or run with his conspiracy theories.
Or do what some people on our own party have done, profits off of asking questions. Asking questions at the basis is fine. The first few weeks, if you're looking into things, totally fine. Let's do that. What are we, like 5 or 6 months later, you're still every single day making millions of dollars off of asking all these questions. No, I don't have a problem with that because, one, there's a widow who, you know, doesn't have a husband to lay down with at night, and there's two children that don't have, you know, a father to tuck them in at night. And they're expected to keep going on, and our movement's expected to keep going on while it's continuing to be brought up for profit. And I think that's a problem there of, yes, ask the questions, but making light of it, genuinely, like, doing comedy off of it, profiting off of it, that's where I draw the line, Brian.
How about the big thing I find with people who are intelligent, they have this anti-Israel that segues to some of them anti-Semitism.
Sure.
So where's that come from? You have a democracy looking to defend itself.
Sure.
You might think they're too aggressive. Okay, fine. Or I don't know. If you spend any time looking at history, you see the Palestinians walking away from every opportunity to have any type of peace.
Yeah.
You see exactly who's financing the hate. What happened on October 7th, and somehow Israel's to blame.
Yeah, and the same
what happened?
The same people criticizing, you know, Israel in that situation have done nothing to support the Free Iran movement, and they didn't do any protests on that. They were completely silent on the streets of New York here.
30 to 50,000 killed in cold blood without guns protesting in the street.
Why? Because it doesn't fit their political narrative. It didn't help them push a talking point on social media. Where did all this come from, this misinformation that you're discussing? Strictly through social media. And here's my thing. Again, you're allowed to ask questions. When it gets into a point of hatred, where it's genuinely every minor inconvenience in your life, you're just going to blame on a Jew, that's where there's a problem. And I think the big difference here is I'm the first person that will say that as a young person, one, we're, you know, draft age. I don't want to go, serve on the front lines of a proxy war for any foreign government. That's okay. You're also allowed to say that we have enough problems, even right here on the streets of New York City, that we don't need to be bankrolling and sending blank checks to foreign nations. That's fine. When you get to a point where you're just saying any person, even in this country that has Jewish heritage, any historical example of even the nation, you're going to sit and bring up and use us as a bully pulpit because you're too weak-minded and you don't have any actual talking points today that you just want to push hatred. And it's really coming to gullible idiots that see it on social media and say, oh, this is fiery and this is radical and let me retweet this because you don't have any knowledge of like the genuine problems this country we could be talking about. If maybe they looked past that one issue and looked at the hundreds of problems right here in America that Gen Z could band together and fix instead of complaining about a country, you know, hundreds of miles away, I think we'd have a little bit more success.
I think it's pretty insane. But I notice it's the extreme right.
Sure.
And almost the whole left of the 18 to 28.
Yeah.
18
you know
to
what
32.
It looks like? It looks just like the squad. The same people who, close to a decade ago, sounded like a really loud extreme fringe that the base of the left ignored and said, let AOC and her group do their press
and
conferences.
Bernie.
Yes, and Bernie, they'll never get big, and now they're basically running the party. If we don't call out the extreme right who's using the exact same talking points as the extreme left today, they will one day be the mainstream party. The more you normalize them, the more you bring them on, have debates, have conversations. That's what I do for a living. I did 10 debates on college campuses where that was the number one issue every single time. Have those conversations. But the second you normalize it, make it the only opinion and make it the number one conversation of topic everywhere on social media, you're kind of becoming what the left is by using their same talking points.
That's
frightening.
What do you think Charlie would say about this? Because there's theories out there of people who say they know him that said he was very anti-Israel and Israel wanted to rein him in and eventually take him out.
Well, let's look at what Charlie actually said. Like just at his past campus tour where he said that it's a weak-minded attempt to sit and just blame every inconvenience on a Jew. You have no actual thought process. You have no criticism of physical policies, of physical, you know, events. You just want to say, oh, it's easy, it's a cheap stunt, and it's somebody that you can just sit and kick down. And again, I said that we don't need to do funding. I said that we don't need to send troops over there. I think we can, a lot of people can agree on that. When you get to a point where you say that I'm just going to blame them for everything, that's where you're kind of becoming the gullible idiot.
Yeah, I just think that people should realize, too, Israel's enemies are America's enemies.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the, exactly. Yes. I mean, they actually say it. And the competition that we have, the ones who can be on our side, the one who's going to be innovative with us when it comes to AI, is it going to be France? No. Is it going to be the UK? Sadly, no. Is it going to be anyone in the EU? No. It's going to be the Israelis.
And speaking of our enemies, think of what they're looking at right now. I mean, with citizens like America has, who needs enemies? Why would Russia or China roll tanks on American streets with our own citizens are burning our flag, looting our own towns, and completely demolishing societies today? And we're having our own civil war on the streets in Minneapolis. Russia and China don't need to roll tanks in here. Why would they have to do that? Because we're attacking ourselves. How did this happen, Brian? It's because, unfortunately, indoctrination starting all the way in kindergarten taught my generation, we were raised to believe that we need to switch gratitude for America with guilt, that we're supposed to hate the country that gave us the freedom to have this conversation that we're having today. You and I can disagree with domestic and foreign policy attempts of the United States of America. That's an awesome thing. You know where they can't do that? Russia or China. The conversation we're having right now, they can't do. But they want to be more like that on the right.
But I think they're financing a lot of it here.
Absolutely.
So Billie Eilish, she won Song of the Year for Wildflower. Guess what? She segued into politics. Cut 37.
I love you so much. I feel so honored every time I get to be in this room. And as grateful as I feel, I honestly don't feel like I need to say anything, but that no one is illegal on stolen land. Yeah, it's just really hard to know what to say and what to do right now. And I feel really hopeful in this room, and I feel like we just need to keep fighting and speaking up and protesting, and our voices really do matter, and the people matter.
That's your age.
Brian, this idea that they're stolen land, I just want to give a little newsflash for you. When we're done here with this segment, I'm going to go head over to Billie Eilish's mansion that's on stolen land in America.
Yes.
Because apparently
she's
it's not hers.
Yeah,
I'm going to go move in today and just have squatter's rights, because apparently that's what all of us are doing in America. So what's the problem of her having a mansion there? She could have used the money that she bought that mansion with in California to give to the poorest of communities that are some of these native, you know, societies. She didn't do that. She wanted to do a cheap political stunt. She wanted to wear her little button. I just want to point something out. If Renee Good, if Alex Pretty were killed by illegal immigrants, nobody would mention their names. Nobody on the mainstream media would mention their names. Nobody would put their faces on buttons. They wouldn't care. Why? Because they didn't care about Lake and Riley. You didn't see protests about Lake and Riley. You also didn't see protests, I don't know, just a few years back, when 56 illegal immigrants were killed under ICE control of Obama's administration. Did you see 56 protests? Did you see 56 speeches at the Grammys? No. And the same people that got on their high horse and spoke at the Grammys last night sat behind the most protected fence in Grammys history and had armed security in the room and outside. Those same people don't want that security for American citizens.
I know. Real quick, here's Bad Bunny, who's going to be playing at the halftime of the Super Bowl. Who's from Puerto Rico, by the way. Cut 35.
Before I say thanks to God, I'm going to say eyes out. We're not savage. We're not animals. We're not aliens. We are humans, and we are Americans.
So, you know what I noticed there? He put his political statement above God. This is a religion for them. Ice out, this entire movement of protest is a religion for them over Jesus. He didn't bother thanking Jesus for the opportunity to live in America or the opportunity to win like the greatest award of the night. No, no, no. He wanted to take that opportunity to do a paid political stunt. What does this give an example of? They do not care about anything in this country. Yes, he has the right to do what he did last night, criticize the government. He doesn't have that right to do it anywhere else, and he's attacking the same government that gives him that freedom. It's insanity. It shows he's an idiot, and I think this is going to be the lowest rating halftime show in history. Check me on that.
Well, I hope so. Is Turning Point doing an alternative?
They're doing an alternative show. They haven't announced who yet, but I'm going to be watching that.
But they have announced they will do it.
There's already a streaming party on my campus, so a bunch of college students are going to get together and watch that show instead.
If people want to see you speak, because you're affiliated with Turning Point, but you're not a part of their speaking tour, right?
Yes, sir.
Where do they go?
Yeah, it's brownhollihan.com. I'm going to a bunch of high schools. We've gone to some colleges. We've got some cool stuff coming up.
And you get your podcast.
Got the podcast, The Brown Hollihan Show. But it's just all on social media, at Brown Hollihan, and you can follow us.
And when people say you're the next Shelly Kirk, what do you say?
Oh, no. I can't fill those shoes. He was a tall guy with a big shoe size. I definitely can't fill that. But if I can just have one little bit of inspiration, that's what I want to do. I interviewed him fourth grade. The last thing he told me that interview, I said, just give me something. Like, I just want to be half of what you are one day. He looked at me in the aisle, never forget this, and said, the left will always out-fundraise you. They'll always out-man you, but they can never outwork you. You control how early you wake up. You control how late you go to bed. You control how many campuses you speak in one day. And we're doing a lot of that. And I'm sleeping. I know I can't say it to you. You don't sleep a lot, but I'm not sleeping a lot right now between homework and doing this. Well, that inspired me.
Well, you look great and you're aging slowly. Brylan Hollihan, thanks so much. Congratulations on your success. Great to see you again.
Good to see you.
Back in a moment.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Ricky Gervais once told the award show crowd, don't use it as a platform to make a political speech. You're in no position to lecture the public about anything. You know nothing about the real world. And of course, this is where celebrities say, how dare you? We're citizens with just as much right to speak out. Agreed, you absolutely do. I'm just saying, don't. Every big name in show business came out for Kamala Harris, from Oprah to Clooney to Beyonce, and she lost every swing state. Celebrities aren't helping. And why would they? In a country where the big issue now is affordability, outside of, I don't know, Springsteen and a few others, celebrities don't strike people as relatable or in touch. And what their activism mostly activates is eye rolls.
Hey, he's 100% right. And also, he does talk about, of course, talking about Bill Maher, how he's never going to be nominated for anything again, that he's now, because he'll go both ways and say Trump, you know, is wrong here, wrong here, wrong here, but he's right here. That's it. That is taboo. You're not allowed to say that and be somebody who's considered liberal. Well, Bill Maher say, well, the more you tell me not to do it, the more I'll do it because I'm speaking my mind. And look, I don't know him. I'm not even sure that he would come on the show. But, or I know he did Gutfeld and was kind of critical on that whole situation, but he's 100% more interesting to listen to than anybody that I saw at the Grammys or I've seen on the left.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, around the world. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. We have an interesting mayor. We knew it was going to be challenging. But when he says, I'm going to leave the homeless encampments up and you better not, NYPD, take them down. Great. The result, 14 people froze to death, all homeless. So you ask me where the compassion is. Also, he's getting some blowback because the snow's still here. Why? A lot of it's frozen, was not plowed effectively, and for some reason, I think it's political. Staten Island, barely touched. Staten Island, mostly Republican, at least for now. This hour, we're going to speak to the Bonson Group managing partner. David Bonson is here in studio. Reagan Charleston's going to be with us, too. That's going to be coming up at a different hour, and Sage Steele at a different hour. David, great to see you.
Likewise. Good to be with you, Brian.
First off, I think there's nothing more important right now than the economy, even though right now front and center is immigration. What is the state of our economy in your mind?
So this is the most nonpartisan, objective, honest answer I can give. It's a big theme I've been talking about to clients all year, that people coming into the year, Brian, with this huge conviction the economy is terrible, or huge conviction the economy is the best ever, are both wrong. Some of them might be sincere in being wrong. I think a lot of it is just partisan cheerleading. But there is, I've never in 26 years professionally managing money ever entered a year with this much ambiguity about the economy. There's $200 billion, by my assessment, of stimulus coming from the Big Beautiful Bill Act, the positive supply side pro-growth type I like, business deductions. So that what you're theoretically you believe is that if you lower the cost of investment, then you get more of it. Okay, that's a good thing. But then I think there's about $300 billion of tax coming via tariffs. Now, they keep taking certain tariffs away. They keep kind of moving that a little. We don't know what the Supreme Court will do. They very wisely pulled back some of the tariffs on juice and coffee and sugar and grocery items late in 2025. But my point is that we don't know right now exactly where things will go. The third quarter picked up, but that was mostly just simply because net trade went higher from people that had been front-running imports. What we know is that best case scenario is the economy grew 2.3%.
Can I stop you for a second? The third quarter at 4.4% GDP growth, don't you think that people have already made their decisions on buying quickly because tariffs were coming? I mean, that came in April.
Yeah, but this was after that. So this is reflecting the other side.
Yeah, so what do you mean?
What it is that you have inventories, people at front run, so you get less. So imports take away. So there was higher before and then less after.
Okay.
And so they would already front run those imports.
But when you saw that 4.4%, if I gave you that, say, hey, you're going to have a quarter growth in America, 4.4%, you'd be thinking, wow, this economy's soaring.
I can't because I know too much. These things are quarter over quarter. We were down 0.6% the quarter before. So I look
at what level was that? Was that, you were saying it was in the threes?
No. We were negative 0.6% in Q2.
You're talking about the shutdown.
No. The second quarter of 2025, way before the shutdown, the economy had contracted and then it went higher in Q3. So when you average it together, let's say we get another strong fourth quarter, your best case is going to get 2.3%. We were 2.7 the year before. We were 2.8 the year before that. No matter what, the economy, best case scenario, grew much less than it did the 2 years prior to that.
And now the Atlanta Fed says the next quarter is going to be 5.
The Atlanta Fed expectations, which are wrong about half the time. They have a 50% batting average, say 5.4. And then there's a number of private indicators that are anywhere from 1.5 to 3.5. So we don't really know. But I'm saying if you get 5, you end up at 2.3% for 2025 because you had a negative quarter in there. So I look at it annualized. I'm looking at the full pro forma. Where are we? And then for 2026, when I start hearing them saying stuff like 7%, which I heard Kevin Hassett say Friday, I just shake my head because I think we might have a good year in the economy. But why? It was like that thing with Doge, Brian, that we talked about. Why say you're going to cut $2 trillion, set the expectation, and then you cut $120 billion, and it's a big disappointment. $120 billion is a good number. Why say 7? It's not going to be anywhere near 7. It's a joke. So the cheerleading ends up distorting it, and then left-wing people use it for partisan aims. Let's just call balls and strikes here. It all comes out in the wash.
So here's what Gary Cohen says about the economy, and he was the former economic advisor to President Trump in the first term.
Yeah, he had Kevin Hassett's job before Larry Kudlow had it in the first term.
Yeah, here, cut 29.
I think we need to take a step back. The economy is quite strong right now on top line growth. So if you look at GDP, gross domestic product, which is the overall output of the U.S. economy, we're trending about 5% right now, which is a very high growth rate in the United States, much higher than the baseline we've had for the last decade. Mm-hmm. So if you look at that number alone, and that's a good number to look at, things are going well. The inflation rate has come down to the high 2%. It's still higher than we'd like it. And the unemployment rate is ticking up, but it's still in a reasonable place around 4-4.5%. So overall, the economy is quite strong right now.
Nothing that I disagree with. The issue is the real wages are always and forever the most important economic component for real people. I have to look at things from the vantage point of an investor for, you know, the kind of deeper macroeconomic side. Real wages, what people made after inflation and incomes, were basically about flat last year. You don't want to see them declining. They didn't decline, but they were more or less the exact same as the year before. For 3 of the 4 Biden years, they had declined, okay? That's not good. People need to be making more net of inflation. So there's two ways you get that. You have price stability, and then you have growing incomes. I'm worried on the income side because I think that you're seeing companies invest less out besides AI. Manufacturing jobs were down last year, and manufacturing investment capital expenditures besides AI was negative. We got to get those other things higher.
How do you get, so they're trying to incentivize manufacturing coming back to America.
Now,
have we seen it?
Not at all. It's the opposite. It's gone the other way because 40% 80% of our manufacturing is with imported products as an input. So the tariffs are hurting American manufacturers.
But do you think that there's a movement to come back here? Like, for example, is it Toyota or Hyundai that's building factories that we're going to come back
here? But they were doing that anyways. We've already, both Toyota, especially Hyundai less so, have always had American manufacturing presence, but it's never been 100%, never going to be. They input certain products from other places. Look, you may marginally get some manufacturing that comes back, but then at what cost? What do you lose in doing that? What are the jobs lost on the export side of the equation, right? There's two sides to it. It's one of the reasons why a free marketeer guy who's a supply-sider like me has a hard time with government picking winners and losers.
Here is Wynn Trump's editorial in the Wall Street Journal. He says America exports are up by $150 billion. Domestic steel production is up by more than 300,000 tons a month. Factory construction is up by 42% since 2022.
Yep.
China's share of U.S. imports has reached the lowest level since China entered the WTO in 2001.
So let's look at the factory construction numbers, up 42%. You know what was up during the Biden years? 77%. Do you see a lot of new people working in those factories? The employment was way down. We have 500,000.
Is it all automated?
Yeah, well, there are obviously going to be automated. So the idea we're building factories to go put workers in to make T-shirts because we're trying to tariff Vietnam, is that's the economic fallacy I'm trying to push back on. And the good news is for America First agenda, we don't need to do that. We can create great high-paying jobs with high-end manufacturing. So when we get on the other side,
we'll never get back to doing
never,
that.
Never.
And that's what got a lot of the people do apparel. Are upset because Vietnam does it better. It takes a skill. Not only do they do it, but they have the skill to do it.
They do
we
it
don't
better.
Even have it.
No, we don't. And we're not going to get it. Okay. And so that's the problem with the kind of promises that set something up a certain way. There are pockets of data that are positive in the economy. There are pockets of data that are not. I don't need to do a midterm election, you know, commercial out of it, right? My agenda is calling balls and strikes so I can understand how to invest capital and make the right decisions in terms of money. And I think that stuff doesn't lie. Here's what I would say. They have a very good chance of the supply side parts of Big Beautiful Bill overwhelming the negative parts of tariff. But what we can't do is pretend there's not a push-pull, a tug-of-war going on. And I think that deregulation, and then I think getting out of our own way. When we talk about affordability, the government creates the best affordability conditions when they regulate less, tax less. When we start talking about trying to manipulate things, make Fannie and Freddie buy $200 billion in mortgage bonds, tell...
You don't like that.
Oh, it's a ridiculous idea that Republicans have been against for 15 years. But I also believe that some of the other ideas were worse. You know, now they've already abandoned
on the credit card.
They're trying to cap credit card stuff, this 50-year mortgage idea, the banning institutions from buying homes. We need more supply of homes.
So you need more supply, but you weren't bothered by the fact that these major companies, I guess I did not know this, but they were incentivized to do it when we were after 2008. We seem to have a
glut. Yeah, I would say they're pretty incentivized right. Since nobody else was doing it.
Right,
there was
so
no
they
capital.
Did it. But having said that, when they're buying single family homes, you could make a whole country a country of renters if that continues.
Brian, there's 60,000. First of all, Blackstone, people keep saying BlackRock and they get it wrong. It's Blackstone owns 60,000 homes through portfolio companies in a country of 90 million homes, 0.006%. Okay. So, and also half of those were built to sell to buyer owners, not for rent. So the numbers are just completely wrong. But in the cities where they did it the most, those cities had the least price appreciation. The cities that had the most price appreciation have no institutional ownership. So the data on that never supported it at all. It's a good talking point. That's why Liz Warren, Bernie Sanders, Mayor Mamdani, they all like this stuff. But President Trump doesn't need to go there. He's got better ideas. He, in his heart, is a supply sider.
How about this interest rate portability?
Interest rate affordability?
Portability.
Well, again,
I have a 3% mortgage.
That's one of the worst ideas that the government would mandate it. For a bank to do it, to try to compete for business by saying we're going to allow you to move your rate. But you would force the government would have to force a total violation of contract law. The contracts don't say that. So to then force it and make a new bank take a loss on something would re-underwrite everything going forward. So this is why free marketeers like us don't believe in central planning, because when the government does one thing to try to help, they hurt someone else, and the unintended consequences are huge. Now, all conservatives have known this. When President Obama was there, President Biden was there, when Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren talk, when you force portability of mortgages, you're really going to hurt the housing sector.
So what ideas do you like that they presented?
First of all, they're mostly not federal. Okay, that's a hard part for politicians, to not just do something but stand there. But the biggest thing to change the world in housing is state and local. I'm tired of people going to city council meetings to protest against building new homes. You need new homes. You need easier permitting. Why were there greater supply in mostly red states and less new supply in blue states? It's all on the supply side. The environmental regulations in New York, California, that's why we were the last place states for building new supply per capita. That's what the stuff you have to do. But mostly what you do is avoid mistakes.
But David Bonson, don't we have a national problem when it comes to housing?
It is not national if you mean all the same. It is too expensive nationally, but it is way higher in some pockets than others. So when you look at Phoenix and Austin and Miami, yep, they built tons of new supply, but the demand outpaced it. And you can't build housing the way you build trinkets by flicking on a switch. We have to recognize, Brian, this is a very complicated problem. You already identified it early on after crisis, financial crisis. The banks were not putting capital into the sector. So we asked private equity people to come in and build. We asked there to be
buy.
New capital
yeah,
investment
build and buy, yeah.
to build and all these things. Now, but then millennials were getting married later. You had a total cultural and generational change. And then the regulatory aspect, all of a sudden we needed new housing. We were 10 years past the crisis and we were not able to do it. And it takes years to go put shovel in the ground and build thousands of new homes. And then the other problem is it's not just about building new homes, because we have tons of replacement stock. There's so many homes that are old and antiquated. So a new home gets built, but it's replacing an old home. You have net zero new homes. And that's a ton of what's been going on. So I don't think there's a lot the federal government could do. But look, they held interest rates down so long, so low, that it stimulated the supply side, the demand side. You can't do that without having a boom to the supply side. When Kamala Harris ran for president and said, I want to give everyone $25,000 for down payment, most of us just said, that's not going to help anything. It's just going to stimulate more demand and get priced in. The exact same thing with manipulating interest rates, with other aspects of trying to stimulate demand, do not help. What you have to do is build new supply. You do that with regulatory relief, the permitting, the environmental stuff. It's nonsensical.
But it's hard to believe that any Democrats would back off the environmental, except for I see a mayor in San Francisco that seems to be a practical side to him.
Yeah.
A mayor in San Jose running for governor seems to have a practical side to him.
And there was a governor in California who's going to run for president who, after the fires, went on Meet the Press, I think it was, and said, we're going to have to waive these requirements to get houses rebuilt.
Did he do that?
He didn't do it, but he at least said he knew the answer.
Yeah.
They always end up admitting that they know it.
Oh, I always think they know the answer. They're just afraid to say it because they'll alienate a lot of people that got them where they are,
I guess.
David Bonson, a few more minutes when we come back, including the headline that got my attention today, is Sell America now in around the world? Are people angry at us? Will it affect us economically? Don't move.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
He's making the same mistake Joe Biden made. Bidenomics is working. That piece in the Wall Street Journal is the economy is great. That's not what people feel. Last year, we lost 70,000 manufacturing jobs. We lost 145,000 blue-collar jobs. There's a great deck put out today by the Washington consultant and prognosticator Bruce Millman. Blue-collar consumer confidence is at a record low since 1976 when they began asking the question.
So that's called Rove weighing in. I think it's, he is rooting for Trump, even though they're, personally, they don't like each other. So with me right now is David Bonson. I like to throw all these different people who are saying different things at an expert like you to make sense of it, David.
Well, of course, Carl's talking about the political side of it, that you want to over-deliver, undersell, and he's criticizing administration.
But you do have to sell to people, right?
You do, and President Trump is far better at that than I am, and he's one of the best who's ever lived. But the problem in politics is it's different than selling a product. You know, at the end of the day, the voters end up getting the results. I believe there's a real benefit politically to underselling and over-delivering, and this notion that, well, the affordability talk is all a joke, you know, why are they putting this on me, and then blaming a Fed or blaming this or that, I don't think it's going to work politically, but I'm not as interested in the political side of it. Carl's an expert there. President Trump's an expert there. He's
what he said about the manufacturing blue-collar jobs, that is your thing.
Well, and then just on a pure data level, this is something I've said for a long, long time, that the way to win back those voters is not to say they're bringing jobs back that aren't going to come back. It's to provide right solutions for where there's economic opportunity.
So there's a story today that's called Sell America. The currency is dropping. Stock and bonds are in a tailspin.
Well,
they don't like the attacks on the president's attacks on the feds. And your thought about Sell America. I know people are looking to sell newspapers.
2025 was the highest year for foreign purchase of stocks and bonds ever. So I just get so tired of the headline and the story not matching each other. I think it's a concern. And I think that if you lower the current account deficit because we are now doing less trade with foreign countries, they will have less dollars to invest back in America. I don't like the threat to capital flows, but to say that it's happening is factually untrue.
Do you like a strong dollar?
Of course. I'm an American.
But when a strong dollar by the words sound great.
It doesn't
but when
mean
the dollar
excessively
is,
strong. It means naturally strong. I don't need a politician to tell us what the dollar should trade relative to euro or yen. Producers and consumers, buyers and sellers. If you believe in free markets, then the dollar should set its own value relative to other currencies by people acting in their own self-interest. The idea that we need a government to dictate where dollars should go or not go, why not let the government set all prices? So let's let Mamdani have free reign. But I think that the dollar was a little too strong. But no, I do not like the idea of saying we want it to be weaker.
I need somebody to cut through all the spin. Thanks so much, David. You're always great. David Bonson. That's why he's got his own Bonson Group. Appreciate it. And thanks so much. I know we'll be seeing you on the Business Channel. Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Nobody is above the law. Nobody's above the law.
That is Don Lemon. I thought it was 17 seconds. It was a little shorter than I thought. Don Lemon in 2019. No one's above the law. That's absolutely correct. But when you see Don Lemon, I've had a chance to listen to a lot of it over the last few days. I wanted to find out why he was arrested. You know, and I went back and I listened to everything possible. And this guy knew all about the raid on the church to the point where he was actually pouring coffee and offering danishes to the protesters that stormed the church and they're harassing ICE. He essentially, in my view, was if you hired, let's say you were trying to do something special, like get engaged or do an Impractical Joker episode, you'd go, I'm going to hire a video team to follow me around and do this. Let's say you wanted to create do a social media thing, and you wanted to go on the beach on spring break. You hire a crew, not a journalist, to go find out what they think of me hiring a crew. You hire a crew. Don Lemon was the video crew for this organized protest that stormed into a church because they thought the pastor had something to do with ICE. And by the way, I think he was a member of ICE, but he's also a pastor, not a Catholic, just some type of Christian church. So he was there. And how do we know that? Because on his ridiculous podcast, he televised all of it. He says, I'm sitting in the back, but if I walk in, they're going to know who I am. They're going to know something is up. They're going to recognize me. So I got to make sure I don't walk in until later. They show him outside the church with all the organizers. I'm sure text messages reveal him interacting with the organizers. What you could do Hey, if you want it, the KKK is going to have a protest. You could text KKK and say, listen, are you going to be on Fifth Avenue? Doesn't mean I'm a member. But if you go and videotape it, if I'm pouring coffee to the KKK as they're about to march down the block and talk about how great white people are, that is no longer a journalist. I am full out supporting these people. And then when you are in a church with a camera interviewing a pastor clearly against his will, just look at some of the video, you know this is not welcome and this isn't journalism. Here's an example. Here he is confronting the pastor in his church, interrupting a ceremony. Cut 45.
We're here to worship. We're here to worship Jesus because that's the hope of these cities. That's the hope of the world is Jesus Christ.
I want to be very respectful. Here. Please don't push me, though.
We're here. We're here to worship Jesus. Yes. That's why we're here. Yeah. Okay. That's why we're here. Okay. That's what we're about.
Don't you think Jesus would be understanding
love
these folks?
We're about spreading the love of Jesus.
But did you try to talk to them as a Christian?
No one is willing to talk.
Okay. This clown is in there. Part of a storming into a church, which you can't do. Third, a great analogy on a podcast that Megyn Kelly had up yesterday or the day before. She said, a lot of times there's a suspected killer or a relative of somebody famous and they're in their house. You could knock on the door and ask for an interview. They don't have to open up the door. They don't have to give you an interview. They certainly don't have to let you inside. Can you imagine, as a journalist, if you could kick that door down, run inside and interview a victim of Michael Jackson's alleged attacks, unwanted sexual advances, whatever. You can't do it. Mike Wallace in the 1970s with the 60 Minutes could do ambush interviews with people on the street, but they can't storm into their house. They can't storm into their workplace and just take over. Now, you could, if you're at ICE, there's things you can do and there's things you can't do. There's things you need a warrant for. There's things you don't need a warrant for. If you're a protester, you can't storm into a hospital and go after somebody who might be a criminal or might be a subject of yours who's receiving treatment. You can't do that in a church, flat out. They did it in a church. That's why they're all in legal trouble. And Don Lemon, in reviewing the video that he posted and some of the interaction they were able to get, is all a part of this. He was basically a videographer for this. Now, the downside is he gets famous, and nobody cares about Don Lemon. He was not getting high ratings on CNN when he was there. His ego was through the roof. Him and Chris Cuomo, absolutely ridiculously in their fake bromance. They're both out of a job, basically. And Don Lemon's trying to do things on his own right now. The bad news is he's getting some press. But listen to Brian Stelter make excuses for Don Lemon. And probably the most asinine thing is his first statement. Cut 40.
I remember the night that Lemon had to evacuate the CNN studio because there were bomb threats called in trying to threaten his show. We went outside to the street. He used a cell phone. He continued to anchor his show from outside in the cold. And I remember once the all clear was given and he was able to go back inside the building, we walked back inside and Lemon got back to the news. He started covering the news again. That's what he wanted to do. He didn't want to be the story that night, and he probably doesn't want to be the story right now. But Lemon did expect after this church protest that something like this could happen. Trump administration officials made noise about wanting to arrest him. Some MAGA media loyalists demanded the arrest of Lemon, wanting to see him punished. This very much has Trump retribution vibes. But Lemon said on his Instagram and on his YouTube live stream, after the first attempt at charging him failed, that he expected the government would come around and try this again.
Well, the thing is, Brian Stelter, number one, he always wants to be to the center of the news. Everything is about him. Number two is, and I would say that Anderson Cooper is just the opposite. I don't know either one of them. I never spoke to either one of them. I think I said hello to Anderson Cooper once. I think Anderson Cooper is just the opposite of that. Opposite of Chris Cuomo. They like being the news. They think whatever they say matters so much, the world should tilt. So what Don Lemon did, the reason why he thought they'd come after him, because he knows he made a huge mistake. Unless he's really naive. So this guy's in a lot of trouble. The communication which shows they're in cahoots. The way he knows these protesters, he's in support of these protesters. And now there might be people that sometimes you have an affinity for. There might be some, let's say you're pro-life and you really support these pro-lifers that are getting arrested outside of church. You don't pour them coffee. You don't offer them Danish. You don't storm into clinics to make sure, with pro-lifers, to make sure that you videotape them storming into a clinic while they get arrested, because you could be arrested too. And I assume he knows that, but I assume he thinks it's worth it. I guess he's got the money to hire what many people consider one of the best attorneys in the country, Abby Lowell. But now here you go. But I'll tell you, I don't know anybody that says, now I got to get Don Lemon's podcast. But I know that the people on the far left that thought he just decided to do other things, maybe, you know, go into investing or farming, now say, well, Don Lemon's got a podcast, so maybe he's going to benefit from that. I don't know. There's always a downside to when you give one of the people that are constantly critical of you more spotlight. For example, the president last night watched Trevor Noah make some allegations about the Epstein files and President Trump, where Jimmy Kimmel make his daily attacks on the president. The president said, I'm going to sue you. Well, that gives these guys more people coming up to him saying the president's going to sue you. How do you feel? The president just put a truth social on you about you. How do you feel? What the president's doing is changing tactics in these cities when it comes to these sanctuary cities. He's going to go for the worst of the worst, but he's going to let these sanctuary cities languish. He's going to let these states wither. And what's happening is, in the long term, the president might not benefit from this, but you see that California lost 4 congressional seats. Do you see that Florida and Texas are gaining? Do you understand that long term, what is happening here? The American public is saying, politics aside, I'm paying too much taxes. It's a horrible environment. I'm leaving the cities. I'm leaving this state. I'm going to find a way to make my career in a state that wants me there and goes out of their way to allow me to live there. For example, they don't tax pensions in Florida. I think I'll retire there. For example, Florida doesn't have a state tax. Texas doesn't have a state tax. I think I'll retire there. Now, what Florida's doing, and with such a surplus, you have Governor DeSantis, who knows how to run his state. I would argue he's best governor in the country, bar none, now says, I'm going to find a way to get insurance rates down, which he's working on, which is still high, but I'm going to find a way to get rid of property tax. I don't know how, but he's going to find a way to do it. I know they have fees, but he's going to find a way to do it. That's somebody that wants you there. Texas is a state that wants you there. Tennessee, for the most part, wants you there. It's so in demand, prices are going up, but they want you there. And New York State, in Illinois, they could not care less, especially in the city. In Minnesota, do you want to move to Minnesota and be run out by a group of angry white women who think that every illegal immigrant is somebody you should be fighting for, especially the criminals? I mean, do you want to go there? I don't think so. Even if you're a left winger, you're like, do I want to raise my kid in a place where they're going to be trained to be an activist? In 5-degree weather in the summer? Don't think so. Nice try. So America will straighten out. And I get the sense that people are going to move. And so many times we're waiting for Texas and Florida to pay the price for so many people leaving blue states and going to red states. It's not happening. They're just becoming redder. So we'll see what happens in the short term. I'm not sure it's going to amount to an impact in the midterm. But we'll see. A lot of game left to play. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this. I also want to bring up what I think is going to be an imminent attack on Iran and why we all should be in support of it. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Don Lemon was arrested. The journalist Don Lemon was arrested along with another independent journalist. And this was despite the fact that a magistrate judge in an appeals court refused to approve the request. And the chief federal district judge, Patrick Schiltz, wrote that there was no evidence that Mr. Lemon engaged in any criminal behavior or conspired to do so. So when do you believe that Mr. Lemon crossed the line from reporting on what was going on to criminal activity?
Conveniently missing from what you just showed, George, is the appellate court and a judge on the appellate court who said just a few days later there was clearly probable cause and it wasn't even a close question. So, and by the way, a grand jury, which is what our system has set up to determine whether probable cause exists, concluded that there was probable cause. That indictment is now public. Everybody in this country can pull it up and read for themselves and see what the grand jury found that Mr. Lemon did.
And that's why it's not just a guy who just wants to chronicle a story, because you're saying, I'm a journalist, doesn't mean you're acting like a journalist. Here's more. Cut two.
But it's interesting that we talk about the First Amendment right. You have a right of freedom of religion. which is just as important as any other right that we have. George, I don't know if you've watched the videos or read the indictment about what it's alleged that Mr. Lemon did, but if anybody in this country thinks that that is, quote, independent journalism, I would like to have a conversation with you. Now, he's obviously has a very good lawyer. He can raise defenses in court to the extent he wants to, but nobody in this country should feel comfortable storming into a church while it's ongoing and disrupting that church service and thinking that we're just going to stand by and let that happen.
And you see, by the way, everyone's talking concerned about this five-year-old who got arrested in Minneapolis with their dad there. When the dad ran, the five-year-old was left alone. And the five-year-old named Liam was brought into a Texas detention center because the dad did not want to leave him, so they stayed together. They're both out. You're fine. You want to be concerned about that? You don't care about the circumstances? Dad broke asylum and all that. You don't care about the details. You looked at a five-year-old and say he was traumatized and that bothers you. All right, that's your stance? Then are you traumatized by the fact that the kids that were left in daycare watched all this horror going by? The protesters were in their face in the childcare area while the adults went to church. What about the little kids that were terrified when the protesters screamed and got screamed at in their face, a child's face? That's part of it, to make people uncomfortable. That's what Don Lemon said. So you can't have it both ways. You can't feel bad for Liam and not feel bad for the people in the church who Don Lemon goes on to say, well, white supremacist. I mean, where did that come from? White supremacist? Because he says that in a podcast later as he does his victory tour after getting arrested, which you should be embarrassed by. I want to talk about the other thing that before we go. So since 1979, when the 52 hostages were taken, I was in high school, 79. I was in ninth grade. Iran's been a problem. Take 52 hostages. And with the Reagan administration, with Oliver North signing Bibles, trying to get the moderates out of Iran, seeing if we could set up some type of alliance with the more reasonable side of the Iranian government. Every time we deal with them, it ends up being a problem. Then we go into Iraq, their enemy of Iran. They send in their militias to kill our guys in EFPs, IEDs on steroids, maim our guys and our women. We don't do anything about it. They go after our planes, go after our people, try to assassinate. The Khobar Towers was an Iranian operation. They try to assassinate our people. Hezbollah is sponsored by Iran. They capture our CIA director. Remember that. All this stuff happened. We don't really hit them backcourt. They take out one of our sophisticated drones at the time. Cost us millions of dollars, maybe $1 billion. We don't do anything. Then we finally start getting aggressive under Trump. Take out Soleimani. Take out their nuclear program. Israel brings them to their knees. And now they continue to try to assassinate Trump, assassinate Mike Pompeo, assassinate John Bolton. We don't really hit them hard. We let the Ayatollah continue to say horrific things about our leaders. And now that's going to stop. Here's Cut 24.
On Iran, the Supreme Leader today said that U.S. attack could spark a regional war. Giving you confidence.
Why wouldn't he say that? Of course he would say that. But we have the biggest, most powerful ships in the world over there, very close, a couple of days. And hopefully we'll make a deal. If we don't make a deal, then we'll find out whether or not he was right.
And I do think the president's doing this knowing that they don't know how to make a deal. They're never going to be trustworthy. We tried five rounds. The sixth round was an attack. So going to a nuclear deal with Iran right now is ignoring the fact that they kill between 30 and 50,000 of their own people in cold blood for standing up and saying, we'd like water, we'd like food, and our currency is worthless, and everything I've worked for has fallen apart, and you're taking our billions of dollars of tax money and giving it to terrorist groups, and we're tired of it. And because of that, they got killed in cold blood, because the Ayatollah says, whatever it takes, kill everybody protesting or attacking. Cut 25, Lindsey Graham.
I think it's a defining moment in his presidency. Ronald Reagan went to the Berlin Wall and he said, tear down this wall. He didn't say, could you make it lower? When asked about what the protesters should do, President Trump said, keep protesting. Help is on the way. If this regime is still standing, the day after, if we pull the plug, will be 100 years of chaos. I have every confidence that President Trump will do what he promised to the people. Help is on the way. Keep protesting. If this regime falls, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, they all go. It'd be the biggest change since the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Middle East has no script. It always has risks. He knows that. But if you look at the upside downside, we're just handing over this problem to another administration that's never going to be as tough as Donald Trump. The ballistic missiles will continue. The intercontinental missiles will continue. The alliance with China will continue. The ones with Russia will continue. They'll wait for a weak leader, and they'll get their nuclear program. And the Middle East will never will adjust by giving nuclear weapons to the UAE, to Qatar, and, of course, Saudi Arabia just to protect itself. Is the world a better place then? Absolutely not. Here's Senator John Fetterman, who gets it. Cut 28.
If they do bring that up, I'll vote it down again, like I did for the first time. I was the one Democrat to support striking the Iranian nuclear facilities, and it was a success, absolutely. And I think it's incredibly, you know, smart now to accumulate all of our assets there around Iran. That is the only thing these nations respect in that region is strength and peace through strength. And now, if they really want to test the president's will, I support. Look at what you're showing on your show. You know, they massacred tens, thousands of young Iranians just fighting for democracy and fundamental rights.
Senator Fetterman gets it. That's why the Democrats just hate him. They hate him because he says what he believes, and a lot of times it's the same thing as Trump, and sometimes when it isn't, he says that too. And that's why they got a primary. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian
Kilmeade. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where it's 5 degrees, that is. Sage Deal's coming up at the bottom of the hour. Talk a little Super Bowl. Talk more about what's going on in the world of sports and life. Also, Regan Charleston's going to be here, attorney on the plaintiff's steering committee in the social media addiction lawsuit that's now out. And that lawsuit's extremely important because it affects almost everybody you talk to who definitely has kids, grandkids, or personally feels as though social media has ruined their life, addicted them to various social media outlets and to their phone, to their iPad. Was it indeed intentional by the social media companies? That's going to be in the court of law. And before we get to Regan, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
If this regime falls, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, they all go. It'd be the biggest change since the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Okay, Iran watch is on as the evil Ayatollah emerges from his bunker to threaten the U.S. and EU and then quickly go scurry and hide. What should we do? I'll weigh in.
Number two.
Last night's victory was historic in so many ways. Look, this is a seat that hadn't elected a Democrat in over 34 years. It's a plus 17% Trump district. Our candidate won decisively last night.
It was a state race, but it was Texas, and it was a red district, and it was won by Donald Trump by 17. This Democrat won by 14. Midterm warnings to the GOP as they lose that state race, but also the governor's race in New Jersey, the governor's race in Virginia. There aren't one-offs. There's a problem. The polls show it. Will they make an adjustment?
Number one.
So for me, people are dying, and you know, I don't think America really wants people going after otherwise hardworking migrants in these communities right now. That's where I'm at.
Senator John Fetterman, a level-headed attitude with the DHS under scrutiny as we go to day three of a partial government shutdown. Is ICE going to get funded? Is FEMA going to get funded? We're going to find out about all that and more and the state of tracing down illegal immigrants in our country. Where are we going to be at? Is that going to be politically viable? I certainly hope so, but a DHS has got to get better. And I think they got to target the worst of the worst. That's where it's impossible to push back on. But another big story that affects everybody is what's going on with social media. On trial, Snapchat. On trial, TikTok, YouTube, and, of course, Facebook. With us right now is Regan Charleston, who joins us. Regan, welcome.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me.
No problem. First off, they want to prove that social media companies were constructed to addict you to... their platform, addict you to their advice. What proof do they have?
Well, you can just look around and see how everyone, children and adults, are connected to their phones. Take one look around, even in the park and traffic, people are staring down at their phones. It's no secret that social media platforms and products were designed to enhance use, to engage the user. It It is the intent of the companies to keep the users on the platforms as long as possible. And that includes child and youth users.
So
the platforms are... Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I'm just saying, but what are they going to use as evidence? For example, I look at my phone a lot, fine. But in terms of whistleblowers coming forward, I know some have come out from working there at Facebook and have come out and said, yeah, this is what they were up to. This was a goal all along. What role will they have in this class action suit?
Well, this isn't a class action. So this is actually a consolidated action in state court in California. This is the JCCP action. I'm on the plaintiff steering committee. My firm is involved not just in the state court litigation, but also in the consolidated action in federal court. That is the multi-district litigation in the Northern District of California. The facts are the same. The platforms, defendants are the same. In this bellwether trial that we're seeing in the state court in California, the defendants are Meta, Snap, TikTok, and YouTube. Importantly, TikTok and Snap have settled. So the only remaining defendants in this first bellwether trial are Meta and YouTube. And those executives are anticipated to testify in the trial. Mark Zuckerberg will testify before the jury. And this is tremendous for all of us, especially parents.
So,
but the evidence is going to show internal documents, the science, what the companies knew when they were designing these products. They knew that the products... And they were intended to be addictive. They were intended to maximize use, to keep users on the platforms. And the science and internal documents are going to show that the companies knew that this was detrimental, harmful, and injurious to children.
So, Regan, here's an example. For example, let's say I make batteries. I can make a battery that lasts forever, or I can make a battery that needs to be replaced every 6 weeks. From a business decision, I'm probably better off making that battery that needs to be replaced. So can a social media company say, look, my goal is to make a profit. My goal is to get people on my website, on my device, on my app, as long as possible. That's called capitalism. That's called business. Is that a valid argument?
Well, that is the very principle behind this, is that the companies have put profits over protections. And there are tools that are available to the platforms to make their products safer that can ensure that the products are not harmful to children, to keep children off of the platforms, but also to warn families, to warn parents how detrimental and how harmful these products can be for children. That is at the very heart of the case. And these companies have put profits over protections for decades now. And this is what we're going to see play out. The voir dire took place last week. It will continue today. Opening statements are anticipated to start Wednesday. We've seen some really strong opinions during voir dire, and it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out. This is the first time that these executives are going to be held accountable in front of a jury.
So without giving away the case, which you wouldn't do anyway, can you give me an idea what proof you have? Besides people looking at their phones, is there internal communication that shows it? Is it whistleblowers that are going to be testifying? And how would you characterize your case? How about that?
The evidence is expected to show internal documents and science that supports overwhelmingly that the companies knew that their products were harmful and that the products cause harm and injury to youth users. This is undeniable, and I have the utmost faith in our trial team, and I'm expecting what will be a momentous trial. This is likened to big tobacco. This is going to change the landscape of tech as it relates to children and youth users.
So TikTok decided to settle?
They did. TikTok and Snap.
And what kind of dollar figures have they settled on?
I can't say. I'm not exactly privy to that information.
But have they decided to stop their addictive behaviors?
There has been no evidence that these platforms are doing anything to limit the harms that their products cause children. It is interesting to see. I mean, I opened my Instagram last week, and at the very top, there's a announcement bar that there are new protections for teenage users of the platform. Why now? Is it because the bellwether first trial is taking off in California? Yes, absolutely. But this trial will have impacts, and the ripples will continue across all of the platforms that we see. And another case that my firm works on and my partner was just appointed as lead counsel is the Roblox case. And we're seeing in this day and age how harmful these digital products are for children. Roblox essentially places child predators in the homes of children across the country. And just like social media, these companies have not warned their users. The parents are unaware, and it is putting children in a very, very dangerous position. And again, profits over protection.
So, Regan, one thing that happened, you know, with cigarette smoking, it became clear that they were addictive. And for a while, they were actually in denial about that. If a settlement gives money and doesn't change behavior, is it really worth it? Or is it just, is that money going to get people into some social media rehab or addictive rehab? I mean, what is the point if you're not going to change behavior?
No, I believe that these trials and these cases will have far-reaching impacts. I think that we're going to see the platforms ultimately change their design and institute protective measures to protect their young users. And I think that we'll see regulations that are going to be brought forth. You see the government's getting involved. The AGs have joined this suit. This is a very consequential lawsuit for all of us, especially parents.
All right. So I know you can't get inside a defendant's head, but why would Mark Zuckerberg think it would be a good move to fight this and take the stand when it could be? Remember Bill Gates all those years ago when it was just the PC was just emerging. He embarrassed himself on the stand. Couldn't Zuckerberg, who's not necessarily swift on his feet, as bright as he is, couldn't he be embarrassing himself and hurting his company by testifying? Why would he not want to take a settlement?
Well, there was a great deal of question surrounding whether Mark Zuckerberg would in fact testify. I think it's ego, but you know, there's corporate responsibility, and this is the first time that they will be held to account for their actions in front of a jury box, in front of the people. And it's going to be fascinating. He is anticipated to testify the second week of February. And that is one that I am very much looking forward to. This is an incredible moment in history. And it's very important for these families to be able to seek redress and that there's some accountability for the injuries that their children have suffered. And this is incredibly important.
And Neil Mohan and Instagram CEO Adam Mizrahi is also expected to testify too. So I guess This is going to be a landmark case that everyone's going to be paying attention to. I'm wondering, is it going to be televised?
No, there will not be cameras in the courtroom.
That's
media is allowed, but no media is allowed.
And then what do you hope comes out of this?
I hope that these companies change their practices. I hope that the public becomes aware that they designed these products. They knew that the social media platforms were harmful. They knew that they had designed something to addict users, to keep them on the apps as long as possible. And that included children. There were not adequate safeguards to keep the children off of the platforms. The products are marketed to children, like I said, big tobacco. When you were looking at cigarettes that were marketed towards youth, I think we're going to see, like you said, this is a landmark case. We're going to see change, positive change come from this. And the scrutiny it's deserved. We have to take a long, hard look at this. These young people have been completely
a whole generation
by their use of an entire generation. And if we don't stop now, it's not just a slippery slope, it's a runaway train. And that's what this trial is going to correct. And this is the first of several bellwethers. But if we can read the tea leaves through TikTok settlement and Snap settlement, hopefully we'll see that the companies are, you know, they know that they're in hot water.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think if you factor in Australia banned social media up until the age, I think, 15, and France is following the footsteps, and New Zealand and others. So there's pushback everywhere. I think the days are running wild around America's youth, thinking that there's some type of benefit. I think people have wised up to it. We now have a case study. We got about 10 years, of people saying, what's the result of giving full access to social media? And most of it's no good. And that's where now we find ourselves in court. Regan Charleston, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. 1-866-408-7669. We'll squeeze in some calls when we get back. Talk more about this. I know it can resonate with you. And also, Sade Steele at the bottom of the hour. Talk about all the coaching changes in the NFL. We got to talk about what is happening with in Minneapolis and other cities this weekend, standing up against ICE as if they're the problem. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I know they're going to try to kick me off here, so just let me try to get this out. First of all, Jesus, I hear you and I'm listening, Lord. I am listening, Lord. Second of all, I want to thank my beautiful wife. I would have never changed my life without you. I'd have ended up dead or in jail. I'd have killed myself if it wasn't for you and Jesus. I thank you for that. All I had was a Bible this big and a radio the same size and a 6 by 8 foot cell. And I believe that those two things could change my life. I believe that music had the power to change my life and God had the power to change my life. And I want to tell y'all right now, Jesus is for everybody. Jesus is not owned by one political party. Jesus is not owned by no music label. Jesus is Jesus, and anybody can have a relationship with him. I love you, Lord.
And that, of course, we know who that is. And he has so many duets. Jelly Roll has so many duets. Which one did he actually win for? Is this for Shaboozy? Didn't he win one with Shaboozy? So I know Shaboozy came out and spoke against ICE, which is so appropriate. But I think that the Grammys last night was all about anti-ICE, but Jelly Roll showed off a 300-pound weight loss at the Grammy Awards. Now, I listened to his podcast, 3 hours, on Joe Rogan, at which time he said that he decided he's going to get up in the morning and he's going to start walking, exercising. And it was pouring rain. And he says, I'm going to have every reason to start the next day, but he decided I'm going to walk in the pouring rain. And he walked in the pouring rain, did his mile or two. He's 300 pounds overweight, and he came back, and his whole family, I guess he's got kids and friends, they're all cheering him that he came back. And I think he did. I think he also took the shot.
Did he?
I think he also took the shot. But still, you definitely need to modify your behavior. The other thing he did is he made everybody stop buying any snacks. He said he used to hide in the pantry and just eat. Eat. So they don't buy any snacks. They don't put it anywhere. He didn't trust himself. He said if you're going to buy anything, you had to lock and keep it away. That's how you lose 300 pounds.
I mean, that's family that wants to help you out. Because a lot of family, like, I'm not giving up my snacks.
He once weighed 550 pounds. Now he looks almost unrecognizable. Hard to believe that he's 500 pounds going around the country as a country music star or heavy metal star, whatever he started as, heavy metal turned into country. And he's getting this huge success, but just traveling around. UK, if you're 550 pounds, he probably wouldn't have lasted another 5 years. Your heart would just explode after a while.
I mean, it would have been a lot, but Pete's not here to tell you this part, though. But he did stuff on, like, WWE, and apparently he was tremendous. Like, he was phenomenal at it, and I think they want to bring him back. And he really liked it, too, which I think was another motivation for him to lose some of the weight and get in shape.
Yeah, so I guess he's now down 265 pounds, he told Men's Health, sporting an all-black tuxedo, which makes you look slimmer, we know, while his 46-year-old wife made a statement while she wearing a metallic latex dress. How do you do that? Does that mean shiny latex?
I mean, yeah, it looked lacy, the pictures I saw, but I also didn't look at extreme detail.
And how would you describe her?
Blonde, pretty, attractive.
Yeah. Which is amazing. Was she with him before he became famous?
I believe so. Yeah, they've been.
That's unbelievable. I mean, he's a singer, 550 pounds, and she's attractive. And she's like, I'm going to stay with a guy named Jelly Roll.
Well, before he got famous, I guess define fame. I don't know when they actually got together, but they've been together a while. They haven't only
every song. I mean, every hit song, he's either singing alone or he's in a duet.
He has a good voice. People want to perform with him.
Right. I guess.
I mean, how else? But are you saying he'd be like in a chorus that, otherwise?
Or I mean, when I saw the list of Grammys on the songs on the sound sheet, I said, there's no way he spoke out against ICE.
Yeah.
I can't see him doing that. Because that's not his thing.
Yeah.
I mean, he was in our studio like 3 years ago. He seemed apolitical. I think he's got way too much going on. But I guess spending time in juvenile hall,
spends a lot of time going back trying to give those kids hope. But not many people have that voice.
That is true. All right. Those tattoos.
That's true. Nor do I. No tattoos. Brian Kilmeade.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Last night's victory was historic in so many ways. Look, this is a seat that hadn't elected a Democrat in over 34 years. It's a plus 17% Trump district. Our candidate won decisively last night, and he was outspent by $2.1 million. He was outspent by $2.1 million, and he still won that seat. He flipped that seat. Again, it's a great way to start the year.
That's DNC Chair Ken Martin talking about a state Texas win, not a federal, but a state Texas win for a Democrat in a district Donald Trump won by 17. This guy won by 14, where the Hispanic population in the area went heavily towards a Democrat, which has got to be scary because when it comes to redistricting, the administration looked at Texas and said, we have an opportunity to take five more seats on the premise that they're going to continue to hold their Hispanic vote. And if they are looking at the aggressive tactics, as appropriate or inappropriate as you think they are, looked at as very aggressive, it seems to be a turnoff to the Hispanic community. If this continues, Trump team in a lot of trouble holding the House and Senate. House certainly, but the Senate possibly too. With us right now is Sage Steele, host of the Sage Steele Show, that podcast. She joins us now on Zoom. Sage, welcome back. I'm sure you weren't watching the Texas state race, but man, that to me is a wake-up call for Republicans, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it's one of many wake-up calls for Republicans. And we always know what happens with these midterms. And depending on which party is in office in the White House, we know how that goes. But I think this time in particular, I'm very concerned, Brian, especially when you look at momentum, even if it's momentum that we disagree with completely, what the narrative has been around ICE. And the really tens, hundreds of thousands of people across the country have been marching, whether it's even in Texas, across the country. I think we all should be concerned everywhere. This is serious.
I mean, it's like the No Kings March. Right? What's that about? I don't, it doesn't even make any sense. But they used it as a way to register people to vote. So they showed up and they were organized. And you go, well, I don't know what the point of that was. Well, it was a show they could organize. They get together and they've picked a cause. Their new cause is in sub-zero weather in Minneapolis. What's ironic, Sage, is I don't see anyone saying, you know, my illegal immigrant landscaper is like part of the family, or I want you to meet my roofer who has been here for 15 years, you know, my meat packer or the executive in my office or my soccer coach. You don't hear anyone talking about illegal immigrants. You see a bunch of white women leading the charge for illegal immigrants, many of which are criminals. There's a non sequitur out there I can't put my finger on.
Absolutely. And also, listen, last night I did something I said I'd never do again, and I watched the Grammys. I watched half of it before I had to turn it off. My point in bringing that up is again, you see the Hollywood elites saying so many things about it as well, and ICE out making all these statements. And the interesting thing is people got up and said, yeah, I'm the daughter of an immigrant. Number one, I think most of us are. And number two, the key word is legal immigrant. There is a huge difference. We are not going after legal immigrants. You did it the right way. We are proud to have you, the most welcoming country on planet Earth for legal immigration. And that there's such an obvious difference that it just blows my mind that people are, it's a choice, Brian. They're choosing to ignore that fact.
So here's Billie Eilish after winning Song of the Year at the Grammys last night, cut 37.
I love you so much. I feel so honored every time I get to be in this room. And as grateful as I feel, I honestly don't feel like I need to say anything, but that no one is illegal on stolen land. Yeah, it's just really hard to know what to say and what to do right now. And I feel really hopeful in this room, and I feel like we just need to keep fighting and speaking up and protesting, and our voices really do matter, and the people matter.
Right. So I always take my cues from her again. So here we go again with the no one's illegal on stolen land. So you could leave
If take your stolen mansion and go to another country that you feel is indigenous to the land they're on.
Honestly, ignorance. Ignorance is bliss, I guess. But the lack of education, and again, I think it's a choice, is just staggering. I will say Jelly Roll, such a positive. Shaboozy, both of whom got up there and were all about their faith and Jesus. And there were people, I think, probably in the crowd. I heard it, but I was probably thinking, oh my gosh, am I allowed to cheer for Jesus? Like, there were some positives come out of it. And I think that that is probably where most Americans lie. Most of us did a very long time ago stop listening to the Hollywood elites and everybody, frankly, out in that part of the country, because they don't practice what they preach either. In the meantime, they are preaching ignorance. And I'm glad that I watched half of it. Now I can say I did it, and it'll be another 15 years before I do it again.
Okay, I can't wait. But by the way, if you are wondering if you should cheer for Jesus, there's very little downside. You know, it's not going to be, well, I heard you cheer for Jesus. We don't have any room in heaven. Here's Bad Bunny, who I can't wait to see at halftime of the Super Bowl. It's going to be fantastic.
You're gonna watch?
Yeah. No, of course not. But I want you to hear cut 35.
Before I say thanks to God, I'm going to say eyes out. We're not savage. We're not animals. We're not aliens. We are humans, and we are Americans.
Yep. The problem is, it's not the Americans that are the problem. It's the illegal immigrant. Or what don't they get about this?
I honestly have racked my brain asking myself the same question, but I think it's just, it isn't even frankly about immigration. This is about going against Donald Trump. This is the ultimate Trump derangement syndrome, and they have just created an even bigger movement around it. Because at the end of the day, everybody knows, like, do it legally. We've never had an issue with it, but it is Trump. And the proof of that, Brian, is what happened over the last 4 years, how they chose to ignore that. And more importantly, I love all these old clips that are coming out with Barack Obama talking about it, and Hillary Clinton going deep on why we must cut down and secure the border. And if you come in here illegally, you're going to be kicked out. I mean, we know Obama has, during his presidency, 8 years. I mean, he deported many more than Trump has even begun to do. So I love that. But unfortunately, the mainstream media continues to ignore it. I will say this about Bad Bunny. I mean, let's give him props for choosing to speak English last night, because he has told us that for halftime of the Super Bowl, you better learn Spanish or else you're not going to be able to understand my lyrics. So I guess we should feel honored that he chose to speak English last night. And the fact that, though, he said he wouldn't be performing in this country again, North America, as long as Donald Trump is president, he's reneging on that next week at the Super Bowl. But it grosses me out. I don't plan to watch. I know there'll be a lot of people hate watching. I'm going to try not to do that. And I don't know if Turning Point is still doing what they're doing, but I refuse to contribute in that way. Will it matter that I don't watch, or maybe you don't watch? Probably not. But on principle, for me, for someone who is so hateful toward the country that has made him like a billionaire, no.
Yeah, I just thought that the goal would be to maximize the viewership by getting people like Bruno Mars or Paul McCartney that everyone can relate to. When it comes to halftime, because it is part of this whole thing, because Sage, you lived and breathed sports and you did your entire life. But these people that watch on the Super Bowl, a lot of them, this is the only time they watch it. Some of them, it's the only time they watch a sporting event, and they look for the entertainment factor. They care about the commercials. They care about halftime. And this is your chance, if you're the NFL, to suck more people in. Or do you feel as though you're so high on top of the mountain, it doesn't matter? I know Jay-Z makes those choices because they kind of license all those decisions out to him.
Yep. They do, which, again, people need to remember. The NFL could still probably have a little more influence, but I think they kind of choose to do this, as do many commissioners of these major pro sports leagues. I just think it's unfortunate, and you know this about me. The whole reason I wanted to become a sportscaster is because sports is the greatest uniter. It's the one place we've always been able to go where race, sex, politics, religion, socioeconomic status didn't matter. But for those 3 hours, those men on that field, none of it, they're just playing football and they're bringing millions of people together. So I hate that it's become what it has. And the Super Bowl, Jay-Z, Commissioner Goodell, they didn't have to make this choice. It was intentional. And now it's up to us with what we choose to do with it.
Right, and we'll see. I think Turning Point's going to have their own option when it comes to halftime. They have not declared what that is yet. Do you know?
I do not. I know that there's been a lot of talk about it. Obviously, they need to announce it now so people can prepare because we're now 6 days away.
So let's talk about the Super Bowl before we get to another one of your issues that we all need to discuss, and that is the Patriots against the Seahawks. Two very different teams from the last time when they met. I was at that Super Bowl. You might have been covering it, too. So your thought about this matchup where Seattle comes in as favorites?
Yeah, I think there are field goal favorites, 3.5-point favorites right now. I actually love the story of both of these teams. I don't have a horse in this race, so I don't really care. But I'll say the fan in me is rooting for the Seattle Seahawks because of Sam Darnold. I mean, when you just think back 2 years ago where he was in your city, Brian, in New York City, and then having to take a backseat to Aaron Rodgers. And I mean, so many difficult times in his journey, and for him to make it eventually there and lead his team the way that he has, I love that. I also love Mike Vrabel out in New England. By the way, I'm in Nashville. I live kind of between here and Florida now. And the Tennessee Titans, like, poor Titans fans here who are so frustrated that they let go of Mike Vrabel like idiots. And look what he goes and does. And he does it in his first season in New England. So there's some incredible storylines. It's kind of fun, by the way, to not have to like be journalistic.
Yeah.
And I can just go be a fan with this one. And, you know, Russell Wilson, that Super Bowl that you were at, which was exactly, was that a decade ago, 11 years ago, when that famous play on the goal line with the Patriots and the Seahawks? And I don't know. I'd absolutely love to see Seattle get this one.
See, as much as, think about this, as much as Tom Brady said he was robbed against the Giants twice, he was gifted that when Russell Wilson threw on the end zone when Marshawn Lynch in the backfield, and it was intercepted. The Patriots hold on to win. And the other one was that inconceivable comeback against the Atlanta Falcons, down by three touchdowns. So those were two that he was, obviously, Tom Brady, but those were two that looked like definite L's.
No, for sure. And that one against the Falcons, I remember I was always, you know, at whatever Super Bowl site all week long. And I never enjoyed going to the game because it's chaos. I like to watch it from my couch with my own toilet, my own drinks. And the only one I was at was when the Ravens, the Harbaugh Super Bowl back in New Orleans in 2012. I had just landed, got home just in time for that Super Bowl, the Falcons one. And I was like, okay, no, he can't come back from this. And I was not a fan of the Patriots, to say the least. And at that moment, that's when I said he's the GOAT. There will never be anybody who can compete against him. And to engineer that, incredible, like absolutely insane. And to me, I don't know how you can even put it in a competition with anybody else. Like who else can you put next to Tom Brady for doing it the way he did it all those times? And now, of course, you can look at Bill Belichick and people go back and forth. Well, he couldn't have done it without Bill. Well, Bill needed Tom, and look at Bill now. It is crap, in my opinion, by the way, that he was not a first ballot Hall of Famer. I think there's politics involved in that with Belichick, but that's a story for another day. To me, that was the turning point where I was like, fine, I might not love Tom Brady, but I love what he did, and I love what he does, and he's the all-time greatest.
Yeah, I think he's becoming a really good broadcaster, too. So the NFL alumni and the U.S. The DEA are teaming up for the third straight year to educate fans and the dangers of fentanyl with one pill can kill, which is unlike when they had cocaine was a problem and crack was a problem. That's called an addiction. A lot of times with fentanyl, I think what makes it so insidious is sometimes you could be saying, oh, you know, I got to study. Ritalin helps me focus, or I'm going to just go get it. And it's laced with fentanyl. You're dead. And you say, well, my kid was not an addict. You're right. But that's the evil of fentanyl.
That's why this is so important. That's why this is the second year I've been involved in One Pill Can Kill. Unfortunately, it's almost becoming like cancer in some ways, where all of us know someone who's been affected by it. By the way, drug-related deaths are still the number one killer in the 18 to 44 demographic. And now we're seeing so much more that's fentanyl-related. we all know how small the dosages can be with fentanyl. Like literally 2 milligrams can kill. That's like 3 to 4 grains of salt can kill. And the scariest part, it isn't just when you're out on the streets looking for a fix, right? To your point, this is being put in prescription pills. This is being put in pills that you can buy on social media. And that's the message we're trying to get out. There's nothing safe for anything related to buying medication on social media. The only safe medication you can buy right now is a prescription from your doctor, because they are putting it in other things. They're putting it in pain medication, Oxy. They're putting it in Adderall for in ADHD drugs. And it only takes this much. So it's heartbreaking. I will say this is the third year, like you said, that the NFL Alumni Health and the DEA have been partnering for this. And in these last couple of years, fentanyl deaths are down 27%. And I also think we need to credit what's happening at the border over the last year for a lot less of that coming in. Thank you, Donald Trump. But in general, these partnerships matter, because we know that kids and young adults are watching the big game. And if we can get this message out as well, enjoy, have a party, go to a party, but you don't have to have this part included in it. And please, please do not ever take any medication unless it's been prescribed by your doctor, because there are bad, evil people out there who are inserting a couple grains of salt. I mean, that's the comparison. And it is truly one pill can kill.
Yeah, fentanyl kills 50,000 Americans in 2024. Thankfully, that number is going down. Fentanyl-related deaths dropped 27%, as you mentioned. And just 2 milligrams of fentanyl can kill you. So don't make that fatal mistake. Sage, do we have a prediction on the Super Bowl?
Well, I'm going with my heart. I am going with the favorites here, with the Seahawks, with Sam Darnold. Listen, it couldn't quite compare to my Indiana Hoosiers and that incredible new movie that must be made. But the journey of Sam Darnold and all that he's been through would be an incredible story, as would Drake May, as would Mike Vrabel. But you know what? Patriots have been there a lot more recently than the Seahawks have. And I'm going to be watching this one very closely. I never miss a minute. I'm obsessed with it. But I won't be watching halftime this year.
and I will say this. Brady won without the Patriots.
Yes.
Now we have Kraft getting to the Super Bowl without Brady and Belichick.
That's kind of cool, Bill.
I know. That's why I thought, I really agree with Rex Ryan. I wanted to see Belichick get the Bills job and then give that one Super Bowl one last chance. How great that would have been, even though he's 73. Oh.
Listen, my husband, he cringes at the mention of the Buffalo Bills, because he's a lifelong fan. And I was Josh Allen is my favorite player in the league. I'll say that. Such a great human being. And I want it for him, too. Yes, Rex Ryan, the genius that he is, but not yet.
Sage Steele, thanks so much. Check out her podcast. Appreciate it, Sage. See you soon.
Thank you, Brian.
Back in a moment.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Hey, welcome back. Just a quick mention. Come up on February 14th, History, Liberty, and Laughs. I'm going to change the show a lot by Reno, but I'm going to, the last of the History, Liberty, and Laughs theme, I'm going to add some augmented to it. It's going to be Fox Nation streamed. It's going to make you feel better about the country after 250 years, but most of all, you're going to have a great time. So go to BrianKilmeade.com for tickets, and we will bring history to life, inspirational, motivational, and patriotic. So hope to see you May 30th at Reno, or in Fort Myers, Florida, February 14th.